Yes. So, I mean, maybe five or six or 7 years ago, there was basically only one way to set up the initial boundary value problem. So, in general relativity, so the problem is you want to solve Einstein's field equations, but you don't want to solve it globally. You want to solve it just in a box, basically. So the main motivation for this comes from numerical relativity. But then if you put in a finite box, so you have boundary conditions, and then you have artificial boundaries, and then you need to impose boundary conditions. And then the big question is, how do you do this? And until a few years ago, there was basically only one way of doing it, which is some famous work by Friedrich and Nagy, who solved the problem. And it was solved in a formulation of Einstein's equation, which involved the Weyl tensor as an extra variable, and in some tetrad formulation. So there was a big demand from the numerical relativity side to have an alternative formulation to this, like a more metric-based formulation, where you could solve the problem. And this is basically what I'm going to talk about today. So the outlines are the first thing. I'm going to tell you about what the problem is and what's the motivation for it. I'm going to mention you some results about constructing absorbing boundary conditions. So there, the idea is that, well, you can start looking at this problem in linearized gravity, and I will tell you why this is not necessarily a bad thing to start with. And there you can you can basically solve the problem in linearized gravity, or at least you can construct a hierarchy of boundary conditions, which are more and more accurate. Then we'll move to the harmonic formulation. So this will be for the full nonlinear Einstein field equations, written in the, I mean, using harmonic coordinates. And then basically your system of equations reduced to a system of wave equations. So then it's easier to solve the problem. And finally, I'm going to tell you some general results about wave systems. So general results to solve the initial boundary value problem for any wave systems that was motivated basically by this investigation of the harmonic formulation. And this general result then will, with the help of this, will be able to solve the harmonic problem. So most of this work you can find in this Living Review article we wrote last year together with Manuel Tiglio. So what is the problem? So the problem is the following. So you want to solve Einstein's field equations. So here I put in vacuum, you could imagine also doing it with some matter fields. But most of what I'm going to say today is for vacuum. And you want to solve it on a given space-time manifold. So you just have the manifold, which is of the following form. So the manifold is you have a time interval here cross sigma. And what the sigma is here, so this is here. So this could be in principle any three-dimensional manifold with boundary. So typically it will be a subset of R3, but in principle it could be any manifold. And the boundary is assumed to be smooth usually and so on. Okay, so then you have this tubular region here and you want to find the solution of Einstein's field equations. And the way you set it up is the following. So you specify initial data here on this initial surface, sigma zero. So sigma zero is just the, I mean, it's just a zero level set if you want at the time zero surface here. And boundary data here on the surface of the cylinder tau.
Do you assume simple topology of the boundary?
Sorry?
Do you assume simple topology of the boundary? Or it could be
Well, at the moment, not necessarily. No, it could be, at the moment, it could be any topology, yes. Okay, and so we want to find a solution of Einstein's field equation so that at, such that at the end, I mean, you, so the solution, the unknown is a metric field. And at the end, what you like to have is that this surface here is a space-like, and in fact, not only this surface, but all this surface of constant time are space-like, and the boundary here of this surface is time-like. Okay, so what is initial data? Well, the initial data that's known, from the Cauchy problem, what this is, I mean, because this is supposed to be a space-like surface, and the initial data is, what the initial conditions are is uniquely specified. I mean, these are the first and second fundamental form of sigma zero, so you can specify these two quantities. And they must satisfy the constraint equation, the Hamiltonian, the momentum constraint equations. Now, contrary to the initial conditions, what the initial conditions are, it's not clear a priori what the boundary conditions are. I mean, there you have a lot of different possibilities. I mean, think of the wave equation. Even for the wave equation, you could have Dirichlet, you could have Sommerfeld, you could have Neumann boundary conditions, or a combination an interpolation of any of these conditions. So basically, the boundary conditions, what they will tell you is how much radiation escapes from this region M. Okay, but this now, what boundary conditions we specify now, that will depend on a specific physical problem you are trying to solve. So important, what we are going to require is that this problem should be well posed. So what that means is two things. So the solution should exist and be unique once you specify the initial and boundary data. So here what unique means, and that's something I have to worry about in general relativity. Unique, when I say unique, at least up to a diffeomorphism, okay, which leaves this structure invariant, so which leaves M and sigma zero and tau invariant. And then the second thing, that is part of this well-posedness requirement, is that you want the stability of the solution. So if you change a little bit the initial or the boundary data, the solution shouldn't change in an uncontrolled way. So in other words, the solution should depend continuously on the initial and boundary data. So where could such a problem arise? So as I mentioned before I started the talk, basically. So one motivation is the numerical modeling of some isolated systems. So for example, you have a binary black hole collision or binary neutron star collision, or something like this going on in the center. And then this system radiates, gravitational radiation in this case. And now here, you have an artificial boundary, and what you would like this artificial boundary to do for you is to be as transparent as possible to the problem. So in other words, the solution that you get inside the cylinder should be as close as possible as the solution you would get if you would solve the global problem, where you would just solve also outside the cylinder. So of course, that's a very difficult problem, because basically you're trying to model something that happens in an unbounded space. I mean, outside the cylinder, you are trying to encode everything, on the boundary of the cylinder. So that's a difficult problem, even for the simple wave equation. So soon I'm going to tell you how we address this problem. Okay, so in other words, what this boundary condition should do for you in this case is minimize the amount of spurious reflections. Okay, and as I mentioned before, so this problem was originally solved. There's still the issue about if these boundary conditions then are really as transparent as they should. But this problem was basically solved in 1999 by Friedrich and Nagy. And then, so this was for this tetrad formulation of general relativity. And more recently, then it was solved for the harmonic problem by Kreis and Winokur, and Kreis, Reula, Winokur, and myself.
Sorry, can you say a bit more about the fact transparency? Because this is transparency from inside, but then if I have a bigger
yes.
thing, then there's going to be incoming an issue crossing that. So you also need to do something about this one.
Yes, so in principle, the idea here is that there's nothing, I mean, there is no source outside.
Yeah.
So
you want to be opaque to this one?
Yes, so basically, I mean, the idea is that there's nothing incoming here from the outside. So
but
you just need to worry about what's.
Is it always possible to extend the initial boundary condition in such a way that you will never incur something?
Well, that's a non-trivial question. I mean, especially here in general relativity, so the problem is that you have the backscatter effect, for example. So if this outgoing radiation, for example, here at each point produces some backscatter, I mean, of the curvature, and so in principle, this boundary condition is supposed to take into account also this backscatter. Now, clearly, this is not going to be possible to solve. So what I'm going to end up with is some approximate boundary condition. And so I will show you exactly in what sense it is approximate.
So there's a way to measure to what extent the things coming from outside is negligible?
Yes, let me advance and show you. Yes, we can have some estimates. Okay, so another situation where this problem is relevant is a much more difficult problem even, is if you have, say, an interface boundary condition. So you have here some star that collapses, for example. Okay, and then you have the boundary of the star, and outside you have a vacuum, so you have no matter fields. And then this boundary in this case then would be the, I mean, this world surface of the star. Okay, so this is what is called the free boundary value problem, and that's a problem that's very difficult even in Newtonian theory. Okay, so here the boundary condition would be different because the boundary condition would provide you a matching condition between what's happening, I mean, in the matter side and in the vacuum side. Then another motivation for looking at this problem, and actually originally this was the first problem that was solved, I mean, before this Friedrich Nagy work, so this was solved by Friedrich in 95. This is if you want to solve the problem in anti-de Sitter space-time. So now this time-like boundary will be the conformal boundary of anti-de Sitter space-time. So now it has some physical sense, so that's what makes the problem simpler in some sense. And what Friedrich showed in 95, so he has some formulation where you can give us boundary data, a smooth Lorentzian conformal structure on this boundary. So it's basically a metric modulo, a Lorentzian metric modulo, the conformal factor. And then this structure has to satisfy some appropriate compatibility condition at the intersection between the initial and the boundary surface. So that's a problem you always have in this initial boundary value problem. So you have boundary data on the surface of the cylinder, you have initial data on the initial surface, and then they have to match together. If they don't match, then the solution will not be continuous, so it will not be smooth. Okay, so he showed if these conditions are satisfied, these matching conditions or corner conditions are satisfied, then for small enough time at least, you get existence of a unique solution. This refers now to the case where you have a negative cosmological constant. So it's not the vacuum case, but the case.
This was at least originally for EDS4. As far as you know, has this ever been extended to higher dimensional EDSs?
Oh, yes. I think that's for EDS4. Yes. I don't know if this has been extended to higher dimensions. Yes. Okay, and then another motivation, something I've become interested in recently, is, well, what you do now, I mean, instead of having an artificial time-like boundary, you try to push this time-like boundary out to null infinity. So in other words, one possibility how this works is you have here your source of gravitational fields and strong field region, and now you take hyperboloidal slices. So this is now sigma 0, sigma t, and sigma capital T. Okay, and asymptotically, these hypersurfaces, they go to null infinity. Okay, so they are always space-like, but asymptotically, they become null. Okay, so and that's very well adapted to the problem. So you have in the strong field region, you have something that looks like Cauchy foliation. But if you are very far away, then these foliations are adapted to the outgoing radiation. And then what you do, you compactify these surfaces. So that means you bring null infinity to a finite distance by a conform transformation. And you end up again with this situation here that I depicted in the introduction. Only the difference now is that now the boundary of the cylinder now is really scry. It's really null infinity. Okay. So the advantage of doing this is now you eliminate the problem of having an artificial boundary. So you don't need to have artificial boundary conditions. Why? Because, well, this surface now is an outflow surface. So the information flows out. Obviously, there's nothing that is incoming. Well, then there's an unambiguous way of defining what the gravitational wave forms are. I mean, you can compute this gravitational wave amplitudes in an unambiguous way. You don't have, in a gauge-independent way. Of course, there's a price you pay. I mean, if you do this compactification, then you will bring, basically you map an infinite region to a finite region so that this can only happen or in order for this to happen, then you get singular terms into the equations. And now the boundary conditions are replaced, should be replaced by suitable regularity conditions here on the boundary of the cylinder. Okay, so existing approaches for the nonlinear Einstein equations, which are based on this particular idea, is by Friedrich in 83. So actually Friedrich managed to rewrite the whole field equations in a larger system, which are called the conformal field equations, which are actually manifestly regular. We can avoid these singularity problems. And it's a big system with a lot of variables. And there's been work by Senginoglu, and more recently by Moncrief, Rine, and by Jim Bardeen, Lisa Buchmann, and myself. So these last two works, they are based on constant mean curvature slices. So you choose these hypersurfaces in such a way that they have positive mean curvature. That's something very natural to do. But then, of course, what this implies, you get elliptic gauge conditions. So the systems that these two systems are hyperbolic elliptic systems, and this is now a challenge now to understand this, the behavior of these systems and how they would behave numerically. The difference between the Moncrief-Rine work and our work is that they use metric fields, we use triad fields. Okay, so now let me start talking about the absorbing boundary conditions. So this is this situation now where we have the artificial boundary. And so the first thing we're going to do, we're going to look at the problem in linearized gravity. And this can be motivated by the following considerations. So we are considering an asymptotically flat spacetime, before we cut it. So we assume we had an asymptotically flat spacetime with some total ADM mass, M. Okay, and we take this spacetime and we truncate it at tau. So we cut out this cylinder here. Okay, and now, as I said before, so the idea is to specify boundary conditions now on the surface of the cylinder, which makes it as transparent as possible. So the key assumptions here that we are going to make are two. So first of all, we are going to assume that the outer boundary lies in the weak field region. Okay, so not the whole tube, but the boundaries of this cylinder here is in the weak field region. Okay, and the second point we're going to assume is that this boundary cuts here, okay, they are going to be approximate metric two spheres. So now I'm making a restriction on the topology here. Okay, and they have area 4 pi r squared, so r would be the areal radius of these two spheres. And we assume that they are constant, I mean that this the area is constant in time as we move from here to here to here to here. Okay, so with these two assumptions, then what we can do, we can simplify the problem. So we can, the first assumption implies that you can linearize Einstein's field equation about the Schwarzschild spacetime of mass m. M is ADM mass near the outer boundary. And the boundary surface now corresponds to a surface of constant areal radius R.
In
two.
Oh.
Yes?
Go ahead.
So the weak field regime is literally defined as the viscous square root of the radius is bigger than the ADM mass?
A lot bigger than the ADM mass, yes.
A lot bigger.
Yes. So there will also be the wave zone, which is something additional that will come up later. Yes.
I guess it sounds like without an additional constraint, you could worry that you could choose a boundary that has a huge areal radius, but that has a big hole, that, I mean, has a big finger that dips into the strong gravity. So somehow, without knowing, kind of having some constraints on the shape
of
the boundary.
Well, yeah. So this is taken care of by point two. So this would be metric, approximate metric two spheres.
Okay.
So this is ruled out by this assumption.
Yeah.
Well, it's related. So I might worry that surely I could create a wave packet kinds of things with fairly little mass, which it would propagate out of the mean. So if you said by weak field, you just mean it's well approximated by linear perturbations. Like
right.
But I'm worried about the connection between one and implies the linear. I can imagine, in principle, there might be counterexamples to that.
Yeah, so we assume you're in the weak field regime here outside the cylinder. So then, I mean, then it sounds plausible that you're allowed to linearize the field equation, the relative.
So as far as you're going to, if I just said by weak field, I just mean I assume I can linearize and that's what we see.
Right, yes. That's what I mean by the weak field regime, uh-huh. Basically, yes. Yes. Okay. Now once you have made this approximation, then you're in a much better situation. So now basically you can, if you know how to describe linearized gravitational waves in the Schwarzschild background, you have the Ricci-Wheeler-Cerilli formalism for this, and you can write in this nice covariant form. So you have basically a two-dimensional wave operator on phi. So phi, what this is a gauge invariant linear combination of the metric perturbations. And then you have an effective potential, which is as this centrifugal term here, minus 6m over r three. I mean, there are two parity sectors, and really that's only in the out parity sectors, but the even parity sector, the potential is a little bit more complicated, but similar. This two metric here is basically the radial part of the Schwarzschild metric, and here we have written it in outgoing and in Finkelstein coordinates, which turns
so
out to be.
You're too deep because you restricted to S frames?
We do decomposition to spherical harmonics.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have here L is the angular momentum number here. Yes. Okay, and now based on this equation, you can write down the solution in a series expansion in M over R. And this was done in a systematic way for a similar problem, for the Tucholsky, basically the Tucholsky equation in non-rotating case by Bardeen and Press in 73. So you can compute a solution to each order of M over R. For example, now for the alt parity quadrupolar outgoing solution, the solution looks like this. So you have a function u, of retarded time, basically. So here you have the second derivative, then you have this first derivative term, you have this term u here, so these are just coefficients, and then you have this integral here. So if m is 0, so if you look at 0 for order in m over r, so you neglect completely the mass of the background, then this term goes away, this integral goes away, and you just have u double prime minus 3r u prime plus 3 over r squared u. That's the quadruple outgoing solution. Now, when you switch on the mass, then you get this non-local term here, this integral term, and the reason for its appearance is related to the backscatter I mentioned before. Okay, so let us look first at the zero, what happens at zero for order in M over R, so if you linearize about Minkowski spacetime. Then you have free outgoing wave solutions, and you can write them in the following form. So if I introduce this creation operator, if you want, then you can, create this outgoing solution from the outgoing solution for L is equal to zero. So that would be just for the two-dimensional wave equation, the S waves. But then as you hit these operators, then you create solutions to higher Ls. Now, this solution, so this is an identity now that you can show. So this solution, so if I hit this operator, I take this operator here, d by dt plus d by dr, and I multiply this by r squared. What you can show is that if you hit this solution with this operator iterated to the L plus 1, then this is exactly 0. It's an identity that you can check by just commutating this operator by b minus with the ALs. So what does that imply? Well, it implies that for given, if I fix some capital L, say 1, 2, or 3, I choose whatever I like here, and I impose this boundary condition here. So this is phi, and I hit it with L plus 1 times this operator here. So this is the same operator as above. Then what we can say is that this boundary condition will be perfectly transparent to zero for the m over r for all linearized gravitational waves which have angular momentum number L smaller or equal than capital L. Okay, so basically you can choose, well, I want to have this boundary condition which is perfectly absorbing up to L is equal to 23, for example, and then you just hit 24 times this operator here on it, and then you will get this boundary condition. So this is very similar to something that has been done for the wave equation on Minkowski spacetime. It's actually very old work by Bayliss and Turkel in the 80s, so this is modeled after their work. Now we want to go back to the nonlinear problem, of course, and where the Recci-Wheeler-Cerilli equation doesn't apply anymore. So what we're going to do now is to rewrite this condition in a more geometric way. And this is as follows. So again, I have this tube here. Now, n is going to be the outgoing unit normal to the boundary. T is going to be a unit time-like vector field tangent to the boundary and perpendicular to the surface here, to the boundary of this surface. So I have T and n, and now I can construct two null vectors by basically taking the sum and the difference of the two. So k is t plus n, and l is t minus n. And then I can complete this to a Neumann-Penrose tetrad. So I take q is a complex unit null vector, which is orthogonal to t and n. And now the important quantity that we will be using to construct this boundary condition is the Weyl scalar, psi 0. So what this is just a contraction of the Weyl tensor. I contract it twice with k and twice with q. And now, in the linearized case, what you can show is that these boundary conditions, VL, that I've shown you before, that are perfectly transparent to zero for order 2m over r up to order L, they can be rewritten in the following form. So you take the Weyl scale up psi 0, you multiply it by r to the 5, and now you hit L minus 1 times this operator. And this operator you can write geometrically as r squared times the derivative in the direction of k. OK, so the reason why this factor R5 R to the 5 appears is related to the peeling property. OK, so according to the peeling property, the vial scale of psi 0 should decay like 1 over R to the 5 along outgoing null geodesics.
Can you say again why? So if the boundary is in the field regime, why was the technique on the previous slide not sufficient? Or what was it?
Yeah, so okay, so what we have done so far is valid in the linearized regime, mm-hmm. right? And now I'm trying to right. So now I'm trying to rewrite the boundary condition in a form that could be suitable for the nonlinear problem. Okay, and so that's what I have achieved here. So here I've rewritten these boundary conditions now in terms of this Newman-Penrose tetrad, which is adapted to the boundary.
Okay. What I'm asking is the idea that this slide will let us, is the point of this slide that it lets us, we need to do this because in the interior, even the interior, there's nonlinear stuff going on, or is it so we can actually move the boundary into nonlinear?
Well, it's just because we want to have a practical formulation of this boundary condition, right? So this is still applied only at the surface of the cylinder, which is still assumed to be in the weak field regime. But now you can formulate it for the nonlinear problem. So because otherwise you would have to compute this gauge invariance quantity, spherical harmonically decompose it, and then write down that would be much more difficult. So this is in a more appropriate form.
Can you always construct the Newman-Penrose tetrad? I'm not sure. I don't know if that always exists, but I would think that you cannot always do that.
Well, if you have a... Yeah, let's see. Well, I mean, as long as you have a Lorentz metric, and the Lorentz metric satisfies this condition I told you before, so that tau is time-like and this sigma t is space-like, then I think you're okay. So what could happen is that the metric somehow develops a singularity at some point, and then you will have a problem. But as long as you have these conditions, then you're okay.
Can you just remind me what the L is and the BL?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the capital L is basically the cutoff frequency. So capital L tells you up to what spherical harmonic or angular momentum number your boundary will be transparent to. Yes. Okay, so one particular condition is this, this B1 boundary condition. So this would just set psi 0 equal to 0 or the time derivative of psi 0 to 0. I mean, that's it. And this is a condition that is usually used in numerical calculations. As complicated supercomputer calculations of compact binaries by some people. And what we did with Luisa then, we took this boundary condition here, and now, I mean, this boundary condition will not be perfectly transparent to quadrupolar outgoing radiation, but what you can do is you can estimate the reflection coefficient. So now you can take a monochromatic outgoing wave, and because it's not perfectly transparent, it will lead to a reflection of an incoming monochromatic wave. And you can compute actually the reflection coefficient. So this is the result. So k here is the wave number. And if you're in the wave zone, then kr is much larger than 1. So this is valid in the wave zone for kr, much larger than 1. So, and that's the result. And that's the result from actual numerical calculation from a nonlinearly perturbed Schwarzschild black hole. So here psi 0, psi 4 would be a measure for the outgoing radiation, psi 0 for the incoming radiation. And you see if you rescale psi 4 with this factor, then this lines up pretty much.
This is a linear calculation? Or
this is a nonlinear calculation now. Yes. Calculation. I mean, this graph here, yes.
But
yes.
If it's a linear calculation,
it's a nonlinear calculation, but still it is a perturbation of Schwarzschild.
Sure.
So it's a nonlinear perturbation.
I'm just wondering if this reflection comes from nonlinearities or comes from just even in the linear
question. No, it happens already at the linearized level.
Okay, that's what I was talking about.
Right.
Okay, so it does happen at the linear.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is it so, and you might think if the radiation is primarily, since the radiation is primarily quadrupolar, that V2 would be the natural thing to take. That's
right.
Computationally prohibitive or something.
Yeah, because it would involve third derivatives of the metric. So you have two derivatives to compute psi zero, and then an additional derivative. So yeah, that would be preferable. But numerically, it gets more difficult to implement. But people have implemented it, actually. Yes. Okay. Yes, and then what you can do also, you can now push this game further, and now you can compute reflection coefficients, for example, if you take into account first order correction terms in M over R. So for example, if you take this B2 boundary condition you just mentioned, then you can show that now if you take into account first order correction terms of M over R, then this will be the reflection coefficient. So it is attenuated by this factor M over R, and then it goes like 1 over KR to the 6. In the wave zone. So for practical purposes, so this reflection will be very small. Okay, so now let me come to the harmonic formulation. So let me try to describe how to implement these boundary conditions now in the harmonic formulation of Einstein's field equations. The way we're going to set up this harmonic formulation is we'll choose first a background metric on the space-time manifold, G naught. That's basically to maintain a covariance, but now the price you pay, how do you choose this background metric? So you have some arbitrarity here. And then you define HAB is the difference between the dynamic and the background metric. You define C, which is the difference between the associated connections. So that's the tensor field. And the harmonic gauge, now you can write as a trace of this C tensor is equal to zero. And then as is well known, so if you do this, Einstein's field equations, so they will reduce to this quasi-linear wave system of equations. So you have here the wave operator. The wave operator is with respect to the dynamic metric times H. And these are some lower order terms which are quadratic in C, but they depend on your first derivatives of H. Okay, and you have the constraint. So this is now the constraint, the harmonic constraint. Now, let's talk about constraint propagation. So usually, if you think about the Cauchy problem, what you say, you set up the problem with some initial conditions that satisfy all the constraints, and then you evolve it, and then you have the constraint propagation system. So the constraint propagation system, this is this wave equation for C. So C, that's basically this constraint field. So C should be zero if the constraints are satisfied, but now you don't know yet if they are satisfied or not. So the evolution equation, they imply this wave equation for C. And if you didn't have boundary conditions, then the fact that your initial data satisfies the constraints, because it's a solution of the wave equation with zero initial data, then automatically the constraints will be satisfied at later times. Now, if you have a time-like boundary, this statement is only true inside the domain of dependence of the initial surface. So if I specify here constraints and they satisfy initial data and they satisfy the constraints, then inside this domain of dependence, the constraints will remain satisfied. But if you want the constraints to be satisfied beyond this domain of dependence, then you need to impose an additional boundary condition, so additional boundary conditions. Okay, and for example, what you can do, you can set these constraint fields to zero at the boundary. Okay, because this is a homogeneous wave equation, then this will guarantee that C stays zero. Okay, now we have 10 wave equations, so we need to impose 10 boundary conditions. Now we have already 6 boundary conditions, so 4 boundary conditions, they come from setting the constraint fields to 0, so that would imply constraint propagation. So what I've done here, I've rewritten this.
The constraints are the Einstein constraints?
The harmonic constraint. The harmonic constraint.
The harmonic gauge.
The harmonic gauge, right. Yes.
So are they gauge or are they constraints? I'm a bit. Which one is this?
They're the gauge choice.
Yeah, they're the gauge choice.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, they're constrained in the sense of the evolution equations. I mean, it's like
the evolution of the gauge constraint.
You're tricky.
Yeah,
it's
which one is equally constrained? So which one are the gauge fixing?
This is the one.
The evolution.
Yes.
Yes.
So
which
one
is called gauge and which one?
So this constraint here is referred to as the constraint you obtained by choosing harmonic coordinates. So that's. So I look at this as a constraint on the coordinate system, or on the more precisely on the Christoffel symbols. It will be at the end. So it's a constraint on the metric fields.
So
right?
You don't use Einstein equation to find this.
Well, for this here, no.
No.
I mean, for the bound for I mean, these constraints are artificial, right? Yeah. Yeah. So they're constraints in a sense, as opposed to the evolution equations. And then you have this psi zero boundary condition that I mentioned before. Okay, and this involves second order derivatives of the metric. And what I've done here is that I've written these conditions explicitly in terms of these tetrad fields. Okay, or derivatives along these tetrad fields. And then you have 4 additional boundary conditions you have to specify. And here we choose this particular combination. So if you look at this whole system, what you find will be important for what follows is that you can look at this as like a kind of generalized Sommerfeld boundary conditions. Okay, if you had, I mean, this condition here just looks like a Sommerfeld boundary condition. So it's a derivative along K of this field here should be 0. Okay, and this is the same. And these also look alike. Okay, now the only difference is that here on the right hand side, now you have a coupling to derivatives, to first derivatives of your fields. So if these blue terms here, they were 0, then you would just have Sommerfeld boundary conditions. And then, you could just use standard theorems to guarantee the well poseness of the problem. But because, well, we don't want this to be 0, we want this really to impose now these constraints here to equal to 0, then this is how these boundary conditions look like now. And if you look here, there's some kind of hierarchical structure. So here you have 0 on the right-hand side. Now here on the right-hand side, you have HKQ, which is something that appears up here. Here you have HKK, which appears up there. Here again, you have KK, KQ, KQ. KQ and KL, so you see KL appears up here. And here you have QQ, which appears up there, and so on. So in other words, in these terms that you have down here, you only have derivatives of terms that appear in one boundary conditions that you imposed before. And this structure will be important for what I'm going to say.
I might worry that these aren't exactly equivalent to what I don't call reflecting my agreements. I might worry that I can have energy coming in with respect to all of this. Is this clear or not?
I'm sorry.
So I might worry that with these boundary conditions, I could have functions which depend on, say, L direction and have energy coming into this. Am I worried for nothing or no?
Yeah, so at the linearized level, I mean, you're backed up by what we said before. So we incorporate here this psi zero boundary condition. So there will be some reflections of gravitational waves, but we know how much we can compute the reflection coefficient. Okay. Okay, so this is a very simple analogy from electrodynamics. So if you look at the at Maxwell's equation, the potential form, in the vector potential form, so you have the box of A0 you have here. So this is what I would call here again the constraint, but this is it's a Lorentz constraint, I mean the Lorentz condition that you impose. And then you can write similar boundary conditions. So you have this gauge boundary condition. Then you have this boundary condition, which is gauge invariant. So this controls the radiation of the field. And then this boundary condition here, that will be equivalent of setting this Lorentz constraint to zero at the boundary.
So I don't understand why you have a gauge condition and you have the Lorentz condition. But you call gauge.
Yeah, it's a boundary condition for the gauge fields. And the reason is that if you look, you can look at residual gauge transformations. As you still have a residual gauge transformation, and if you look how this function psi, what it satisfies, it is satisfied the wave equation here, and then from this boundary condition you get this condition here. Okay, so and this is basically what controls the psi here. Okay, so now the last step now in the talk or in this work is to establish the well-posedness of this. Boundary conditions. So we have these boundary conditions here, or these boundary conditions here in the Maxwell case, and we want to establish well-posedness. And well, I don't have time to go into the details, but the key result here is to show strong well-posedness. So that's a concept that was established by Kreis for initial boundary value problems. And what this means, and here for simplicity, let me just explain what this is for the wave equation with the simple Sommerfeld boundary condition. So what this means is that you can estimate the L2 norm of the gradient of phi. You can estimate by some constants times that will be the gradient of phi on the initial surface plus the norm of the inhomogeneity you put here on the boundary. But then the important thing, you want also to estimate the gradient of phi on the boundary. Okay, so this is this red term here is the important thing. And why is it important? Well, because basically it tells you that this boundary condition is stable in some sense. So if I could add to G some derivatives of phi with a small enough factor, and if I do this, so I would get here additional terms with the derivative of phi, but if it's small enough, I can pass it to the other side and get an estimate. Okay, and thanks to this strong well-posedness, then what you can show is you can establish, I mean, you can show that for wave systems like Maxwell's equation here, which are coupled, so where you have basically Sommerfeld boundary conditions, but they're coupled here on the right-hand side by derivatives of your fields, you can, if you have strong well-posedness, then you can show strong well-posedness of the coupled system. I mean, if you have strong well-posedness for the single, for the wave equation, then you can show strong well-posedness for the coupled system. And actually, it's very interesting how this strong well-posedness, I mean, how you show this, and this is related to the many-fingered nature of space-time. So how you construct typically this energy estimates is, I mean, you can do it in a very geometric way by considering the stress energy tensor of the scalar field. And what would you do? What you do, you contract T mu nu with any future pointing time-like vector field, so you get a current density, J. And this J then satisfies some kind of divergence law. And then what you do typically, you integrate this divergence law, you use Gauss theorem, and then you get an energy balance equation. Now it turns out that it's crucial here to show strong well-posedness. It's important how you choose this U. And the error we are doing for some very long time is we are choosing U tangents to the boundary surface because that's a natural thing to do. Now, if you do this, then you don't get strong well-posedness. I mean, you cannot show strong well-posedness in this way. And the trick is that you have to choose U, this vector field U, outgoing at the boundary. And if you do this, then you get this strong well-posed estimate. And actually, so some very similar non-standard energy estimates are actually used nowadays for the, I mean, they were used before already in the nonlinear stability proofs of black holes by D'Affermos and Ronyansky, for example. Okay, now let us generalize a little bit what we have done so far. So now instead of the harmonic system, now let us look at this general system of wave equations. So phi A now is a collection of fields. This is again the wave operator. So this metric here now may depend on phi pointwise. And this is just some source terms, depends on phi and its first but not second derivatives. And we are specifying initial data for phi A and its first derivative in time. So GAB is supposed to be Lorentz metric and so on. And what we do now to formulate the boundary conditions, we consider again this tetrad I mentioned before. So we have the outgoing normal vector T here, a future directed unit vector, and then you can construct K and L, which are null vectors, and complete it to a Newman-Penrose tetrad. Now here, unit orthogonal time-like and so on, that refers now to this dynamical metric GAB, which depends on phi. There's an issue now here about the uniqueness of how to choose T. I won't go into it. And the main result is the following one. So consider this initial boundary value problem. So you have this system here of wave equations, this collection of fields. So this is in general nonlinear system, a quasi-linear system. You specify initial data. And now the boundary conditions, they have the following form. So you have here, this is would be the sum of just the derivative of phi in the k direction, the null direction, outgoing null direction. So that will be the sum of L condition. You can put some data here. And now this is the coupling now to the derivatives of the other fields. And the important point here to note is that these coefficients here, CAB, they have to be in this nilpotent form. So in other words, for fixed little a, this CAAB, this is a diagonal matrix, which has zero in the diagonal. A triangular matrix, okay? Triangular matrix with zero in the diagonal. Okay, and basically, because it's nilpotent, that means that if you, by appropriately rescaling the fields, you can make it arbitrary small. And then you can use this strong well-posens result, which I showed before. Okay, so the theorem says that under this condition, then the problem is well-posed. And since the problem I showed you before, so the harmonic gauge, the harmonic Einstein equation and the electromagnetic case, they were precisely of this form. So with this theorem, immediately we can establish the well-posens of the initial boundary value problem I showed you before for the full nonlinear harmonic Einstein equations. You can also use this theorem to look at higher order boundary conditions, like this BL, this B2 boundary condition, for example. You can also push it a little bit farther and show that this system is also okay. Okay, so the conclusion, so it is now possible to formulate a well-posed initial boundary value problem for Einstein's vacuum equations in the harmonic, using harmonic coordinates. So as I just show you, so this formulation or the motivation for this problem, say, has spurred research, in formulating this as a general theorem for systems of wave equations. So in principle, this could be also applied to other fields like the Maxwell equations in potential form or the Young-Mills equations. So there's still some issue about this initial boundary value problem related to geometric uniqueness, so that's still an open question. And as I mentioned in introduction, so currently there is an effort in trying to push the boundaries out to null infinity. So to I mean, to really compute the gravitation waveforms, that's scry.
Geometric uniqueness means uniqueness of the digit morphism.
Right.
That's what you mean. What? What
did you say? Means uniqueness of the digit morphism.
Yes.
One technical question, you didn't mention whether you're restricting the intersection of the boundary in the slice to the octagonal, or it's totally general?
No, that's not necessarily. It's not necessarily. Not necessary.
So, having thought now with this structure, how perhaps Cauchy characteristic matching could be done between matters?
Yes, so actually part of the motivation for doing this, I mean, from Jeff Winnicker's side at least, was to do this Cauchy characteristic matching. So I mean, this set is now the Cauchy part of it, but now I guess you need to look back at the characteristic parts of it.
But at least now you know what is the structure of the communication from the inside.
Right.
And what would the characteristic side be doing?
Yes.
This pushing the boundaries to null infinity, that's related to the constant mean curvature slicing you were talking about, because if you take positive curvature, you curve.
Right.
Too.
Yes.
I didn't understand that before. So what is the, out at null infinity, there will be constant mean curvature slices. Is there some theorem that you can find constant mean curvature slices all through the, can you slice up the space? You can slice up the space?
Or the existence, yeah. So in general, so given any asymptotically flat space-time, you are asking if you can foliate them. Yeah, I think there are results, but I'm not familiar with them. I mean, they are.
Yeah, but it's not complete. You're missing part of this space.
In principle, have a general formulation, a general slicing some. Localized region, we all need a constant curvature. Okay, so let's thank Olivier again.